Chapter 25.
Our friend, Harry James's brother, William, sees the I in each of us as the active agent, the first-person doer, as it were, that part of our consciousness or being which sets our goals and initiates our actions in quest of those goals, whether the goals be getting closer to a pretty girl or being seen as the best writer of our generation, said Clemens between deep draws on his cigar. Does anyone here disagree with such a definition?
No one spoke for a moment, and James returned his attention to the sound of the breeze in the nearby trees. Then Holmes said,
This seems somewhat self-evident, perhaps to the point of being obvious. Quite so, cried Clemens. Then perhaps you will also agree with Mr. William James's definition of me as being the third-person object of self-reflection, reflecting on one's own traits, as in, am I a friendly person? Or pondering our own beliefs, as in, do I really believe in an all-powerful God? Or do I really like chocolate? As well as querying our states, am I angry that Clemens is wasting my time like this, and so on? What does this have to do with the question of whether Mr. Holmes exists or not? Asked Howells.
Clemens put a hand on his old friend's knee.
Be patient, Howells. Be patient.
Clemens removed his hand and clasped both hands over his stomach while he began to rock again. Then he removed the cigar and flicked ash on the wooden floor of the porch.
Our friend Henry James's brother William explained to me that these two parts of each of us, the self as known, the me, and the self as knower, the I, are in constant interplay, sometimes actively competing with one another. How can this be? Asked Holmes. A man's deepest self, his soul, as it were, cannot be divided against itself. Can it not be? Said Clemens. Are we not, each of us, in our deepest selves, divided against ourselves? The me asks, am I not a kind man? And hopes it to be so, even while our I commits selfish or thoughtless actions which hurt our spouses, our children, our closest friends. Have you not encountered, Mr. Holmes, rogues who committed the worst of actions, murder even, yet insist they are good people, decent people, and that their heinous crimes were mere temporary aberrations done, as it were, against their will?
I have, said Holmes after a moment, but I fail to see how this has anything to do with the question of whether I am real or a fictional construct, existing only within the confines of some author's imagination. Clemens nodded and flicked ash.
Our little bark is heavily loaded, but we trust that it will reach shore by and by, Mr. Holmes. The I in us acts. The me in us weighs those actions as we reassure ourselves that we are really fine fellows after all. And since the me becomes what your brother called our empirical selves, the ones people see and know, it becomes the one the world knows.
He exhaled a small cloud of smoke and pulled a folded slip of paper from his vest pocket. No one spoke as Clemens unfolded the page and held it at arm's length to read.
As your brother writes, Mr. James, I am often confronted by the necessity of standing by one of my empirical selves and relinquishing the rest. Not that I would not, if I could, be both handsome and fat and well-dressed and a great athlete and make a million a year, be a wit, a bon vivant, and a lady killer, as well as a philosopher, a philanthropist, statesman, warrior, and African explorer, as well as a tone poet and saint. But the thing is simply impossible. The millionaire's work would run counter to the saint's. The bon vivant and the philanthropist would trip each other up. The philosopher and the lady killer could not well keep house in the same tenement of clay. Such different characters may conceivably at the outset of life be alike, possibly to a man. To make any one of them actual, the rest must more or less be suppressed.
So the seeker of his truest, deepest self must review the list carefully and pick out the one on which to stake his salvation. All the other selves thereupon become unreal, but the fortunes of this self are real. Its failures are real failures. Its triumphs are real triumphs, carrying shame and gladness with them. There was a long silence, common to groups who have just had a long passage read to them, and then Howells said plaintively, "Sam, how on earth did you just happen to have that page at hand to read?" Clemens grinned. He looked at Henry James. "I tore it out of this man's brother's book, Principles of Psychology, in my library, not 10 minutes ago." "For shame," said Howells. "It is better to break the spine of a man than of a book," murmured James. "Oh, its spine is intact," said Clemens, "but I confess to the crime of ripping a page out of the guts of William's beautiful book. He peered at both sides of the page. "Pages 309 and 310. "Unforgivable," said Howells. "I shall do my best to repair it," said Clemens. "I am, you know, in the bookbinding business myself." He turned to Sherlock Holmes. "Did that passage not reassure you that even though you are a fictional character, your failures would be your own? Your triumphs would be your own?" "It did not," said Holmes. "If I am some hack author's pawn, then neither my triumphs nor failures can I call my own." Clemens sighed. Howells said, "That's all very well for this theoretical me, that is, at any given moment, the sum of all behaviors, decisions, and possessions. But what about the I? Where is it all this time?" When no one spoke, James cleared his throat and said, "The I knows all past thoughts and appropriates them, but outside of time, as it were. Since the I itself is a thought from moment to moment, each different from that of the last moment, but appropriative of the latter, together with all that the latter called its own." The other three men were staring at James as if he'd broken wind. Howells ground out his cigarette underfoot. Holmes was holding his pipe in his lap. "You see," continued James, knowing that he should say no more, "William's logic is that since the stream of thought in each of us is constantly changing, there is no reason to suppose some fixed entity beyond the stream itself. No soul, no central spirit, no ego as such. Rather, there are pulses of consciousness, thoughts which are unified in and of themselves, involving, among other things, the immediate awareness of the body. And William thinks that these thoughts, as sovereign eyes, can remember and appropriate prior thoughts to the stream. But the eye is always in motion, always in flux, part of a greater stream of consciousness, one might say." Sam Clemens tossed his stub of a cigar over the porch railing.
"Yep, that's pretty much what Mr. William James and I thrashed out in Florence, at least by the time the espresso had come."
"You explored all this with my loquacious brother over the course of a mere dinner?" asked James.
"Never in your life," cried Clemens. "It was over a long Italian dinner, then brandy and coffee, and dessert and cheese, and then more brandy, and then the espresso. The world was created in less time, or at least its peninsulas and fjords were."
"But you are speaking of identity, Sam, not of reality of existence," said Howells.
"Are they not the same thing?" asked Clemens.
"My little dog knows me, therefore I am myself.
Identity, good sirs."
"My little dog knows me, therefore I am?" James asked dryly. "This was the depth and breadth of my brother's philosophy?"
"Not quite," said Clemens.
Your brother William explained to me that, in its widest sense, a man's self is the sum total of all that he can call his. Not only his body and its ailments and his psychic powers, such as they are, but also his clothes and his wife and children, his ancestors and friends, his competitors and sworn enemies, his reputation and works, his lands and horses and yacht and bank account. I have no yacht, Howells said softly. Non navigare, ideo non esse. James and Holmes both surprised themselves by laughing. Howells did not sail, therefore he was not.
Ego navigare, ergo sum, said Holmes. Except that I don't. Sail, that is.
Now even Sam Clemens joined in the laughter. Suddenly Howells cried, Look! And pointed. A deer bolted across the shade-dappled lawn behind Harriet Beecher Stowe's home. It disappeared into shrubs to the north, and the men on the porch remained quiet. James was wondering whether he should suggest that they go. He and Holmes had a long train ride ahead of them. Clemens spoke, and his voice had a strange, strained, changed, distant tone to it.
Just before I sailed from Genoa last week, he said softly, no longer rocking. My daughter Susie celebrated her 21st birthday. It bothered me for some reason, in more ways than having a father's daughter grow up and thus never again be his little girl, which is bothersome enough, God knows. My own birthday was last November. I turned 57 years old, and I remember thinking, I think it to this day, that I wished it were 17 or 97. Any age but 57.
When no one else said anything, James found himself thinking of his own 50th birthday, less than 2 weeks away now, and how he had long vowed that he would be recognized as master in his field by the time he was 50. Instead, he could barely get a new short story published. He was attempting to start over as a writer at age 50 to make his fortune in writing for the stage. His enthusiasm for that self-transformation had waned a little more each day since he had left Paris and steamed to America. He knew that Howells was 56 years old. Clemens, as he complained, was soon to turn 58 years old. Holmes was the relative youngster in the group, only 39.
People wonder why I've traveled back to the United States so much, and why I shall continue to do so, no matter how long our European exile lasts, Clemens was saying. So when they ask, why do you go so much, Mr. Twain? I say to them, well, I go partly for my health, partly to familiarize myself with the road. But mostly I go, gentlemen, primarily to convince the me in me that I truly exist, that there is something more to Mr. Samuel Clemens than his clothes and his wife and his children.
All four of them had ceased rocking now, and three of the men were looking at the white-haired humorist.
You see, I dreamed that I was born and grew up and was a pilot on the Mississippi, gentlemen, said Clemens, his voice little more than a whisper. I dreamed that I was a miner and journalist in Nevada and a pilgrim in the good ship Quaker City and wrote a very popular book about those travels abroad and that I had a wife and children, yes, and went with them to live in a villa just outside of Florence. And this dream goes on and on and on, and sometimes it seems so real that I almost believe it is real. But there is no way to tell. No way to tell, Mr. Holmes, Mr. James, my dear Howells. For if one applied tests, then they would be part of the dream too, and so would simply aid in the deceit. I wish I knew. I wish I knew.
Clemens looked down, and for a terrible moment, James thought he might be weeping.
Knew what, Sam?
Asked Howells. Clemens looked up at them and his eyes were dry, distant, with a tired and haunted look, but dry.
I wish I knew whether it all was a dream or real, he said.
Livy is real, said Howells.
You have that indisputable point of reality to cling to when the black dog and blue devils try to pull you down.
Livy, oh, Livia,
said Clemens and nodded.
I wrote not long ago about Adam and Eve, about how Adam had no name for this new creature taken from his rib, and how he became bewildered by all these new events over which he had no control. He resented her, you see. She was an intrusion on the placid perfection of his life alone in the garden. But after years passed, I had Adam change his mind. I see that I was mistaken about Eve in the beginning, he says, for it is better to live outside the garden with her than inside it without her.
James thought that Clemens was finished with his long digression, but the humorist cleared his throat and said,
When Eve finally dies, after centuries with Adam, I have Adam carve her headstone on wood, and on that slab of wood he has carved, where she was, there was paradise.
Clemens looked around with an expression of embarrassment.
Well, we are discussing Mr. Holmes's reality and identity, gentlemen. Mr. Holmes...
He looked directly at the detective.
Mr. Holmes, you will have an identity as long as there are deerstalker caps and magnifying glasses in the world.
Clemens pantomimed holding the handle of a magnifying glass. Howells chuckled.
Oh, dear God,
moaned Holmes. He folded his hands into fists and set his fists on his knees.
The artist for the Strand, the artist who draws versions of me, said Holmes, is named Sidney Paget. I have never had the dubious pleasure of making his acquaintance, and he, in turn, has never set eyes on me. I have never allowed my photograph or a photogravure to appear in any newspaper, no matter how major the crime might have been or how clever the apprehension of the criminals. Paget has only the vaguest idea, through Watson's stories, of what I look like or how I dress. Since the Strand had originally intended Sidney's older brother Walter to be the illustrator of the stories, perhaps Walter Paget's only consolation is that his younger brother uses him as his model for me. That is, for the detective Sherlock Holmes as illustrated in The Strand.
Holmes struck his walking stick hard against the wooden floor of the balcony.
I do own a soft, two-flapped cap like that, but hardly wear it constantly as the Paget illustrations would have it. And yes, I do, upon occasion, travel in a wool, caped traveling overcoat, but so do thousands of other English gentlemen when leaving the city. And here is the magnifying glass I use to examine dust, ash, particles, fibers, and other minute clues.
Holmes reached in his jacket pocket and pulled out a tiny magnifying lens with no handle. It was black-rimmed and thick, the sort of glass one would use to magnify tiny details on a large map. Clemens and Howells were laughing at Holmes's outburst, and James could not help it. He also chuckled.
Well,
said Clemens as Holmes sat silent, leaning on his stick,
I only wish I had a trademark like your deerstalker hat, caped coat, and magnifying glass, Mr. Holmes. God knows I do love being known and recognized. Providence and Presbyterians, please forgive me. I live for recognition and for my own insignificant little bit of fame. Life is short enough, is my belief, without passing through it unnoticed by the multitudes. If you hadn't become known for your deerstalker cap, Mr. Holmes, perhaps I would be wearing one myself. I do so enjoy standing out in a crowd. Go about a German or American city in a deerstalker, said Howells, and you will stand out in an asylum.
James chuckled again. Sherlock Holmes said,
Wear white.
I beg your pardon, said Clemens.
He was preparing a new cigar.
Wear a white suit, but with your regular black shoes, said Holmes. I wear white suits from time to time every summer, said Clemens, puffing the cigar to a glow. A lovely, comfortable, white linen suit. And yes, with my regular black shoes, which is a mortal sin and unspeakable faux pas at Newport and at several clubs to which I've been invited. But alas, I am only one white suit amidst thousands as the temperatures soar and the season of white suits rolls around.
Wear them in the winter, said Holmes.
Year-round.
Year-round, repeated Clemens, looking to Howells, who only smiled and shrugged.
They will put me in an asylum if I start doing that.
With your notoriety, fame, I should say, said Holmes, and with your mane of white hair, it will be seen as an attractive eccentricity, a whim of a great and amusing man. You will stand out in every crowd, at least from September to May. The white suit shall become, one could say, your signature in society. Behold, Mark Twain cometh.
Clemens laughed along with the rest of them, but there was a calculating look in his eye. Henry James, allowing himself to get into the mood of the moment, which was very rare for him, said,
If anyone asks why you wear white linen suits all winter, Mr. Clemens, tell them that cleanliness is paramount for you, and that you have become aware that men's black suits merely hide the dirt and soot. How many weeks or months or years go between cleanings of those dark suits? No, sir, you will not be part of that suspiciously dark crowd. Cleanliness is next to godliness, you can say, and Mark Twain is next to his white linen suit.
This time Clemens threw his head back and roared with the others. Howells stayed in Hartford with Clemens as the humorist made his afternoon round of visits and had dinner with old Connecticut friends who might just have money to invest or loan. James and Holmes took the afternoon train back to New York, where they would catch the evening train to Washington.
Henry Adams will be home in a very few days, said James after they had made the connection in New York. I'm a trifle curious how you will present yourself to him. The intrepid Norwegian explorer Jan Sigurdsson or the consulting London detective Sherlock Holmes? Of course, you and John Hay have 3 or 4 days to decide the better course.
Holmes was reading a small guide to Chicago that he had picked up at a Grand Central Station kiosk, but now he looked up at James sitting across from him.
I'm afraid Hay and I have no more time to discuss such things. Mr. Adams is returning today, almost certainly before you and I arrive at Mr. Hay's home.
James blinked rapidly.
But John Hay said, the servants said, everyone said.
He calmed himself and leaned on his stick.
Are you sure of this, Mr. Holmes?
I am, Mr. James.
So will you be introduced to Adams as Sherlock Holmes or as Mr. Sigurdsson?
Asked James.
With luck, by tomorrow morning we'll have shifted quarters to those nearby rooms to let about which Mr. Hay talked to you. You are certain they will be satisfactory?
They were in 83 when I was here last, and Clover Adams arranged for me to stay there, said James. Light, clean rooms, and Hay says that we shall each have a corner bed sitting room of our own.
Holmes nodded.
The privacy help in my investigations.
James looked out at the countryside passing by, the small white houses and red barns and newly plowed fields and small remaining bits of forest enriched by the warm light of the setting sun and the long shadows. When he turned back, he said,
I take it you would rather meet Henry Adams as yourself, as Holmes.
It would simplify much,
said Holmes, and they rode in silence for half an hour or so.
Mr. James, said Holmes at last, since we may not have the opportunity for a private conversation for some time to come, allow me to say, Mr. Clemens's reprise of your brother William's theory of self, of I and me, was of the greatest interest to me.
James nodded his appreciation and stifled a laugh. He'd been in his older brother's shadow for 50 years now, and while he loved William dearly, part of James still wanted to follow William around and be in his presence constantly as he did when he was a small boy. He would, at age 50, appreciate stepping into the sunshine of praise for his own work, his own achievements, his own life.
"I mention it," continued Holmes, "because I see the same analysis of the polyphonic dialogic of multiple selves, and most especially of the spiritual core, the I caught up constantly in the flow of thoughts and events, what your brother so brilliantly labeled as the stream of consciousness. In your writing, sir, that is, in your stories and novels and characters, it is astonishing to me that two brothers, usually separated by an ocean, could so masterfully come to the same impression and explanation of human consciousness. Your brother from the scientific side, and you, even more powerfully, from the literary."
For the first time in years, Henry James found himself speechless. Finally, he managed to say, "Thank you, sir. You have read my work?" He heard the odd tone in his own voice in that query.
"I've read and enjoyed your work for years," said Sherlock Holmes. "For reasons that may be all too obvious, I found your The Princess Casamassima a wonderful examination of how the working classes in England and America turn to anarchy, and thus to terrorism."
James again nodded modestly toward his interlocutor. The author had been inordinately fond of his The Princess Casamassima. For one thing, the novel was a far cry from Daisy Miller and his many stories about young American women encountering Europe, but the critical response to the book had been muted and mixed. As if reading his mind again, Holmes said,
"I happened to read one review in the Times that criticized the book and you for placing so much of the social interaction on Sundays."
Holmes shook his head and smiled.
"That reviewer, and perhaps too many of our upper classes, simply don't realize that for the foreign working class you are describing, Sunday afternoons are the only time they have for any sort of social activity."
"Exactly," said James, who had actually researched his novel about the foreign-born working classes more diligently than any other work he'd written. "Thank you for realizing that."
"The prison so aptly described in your book was Millbank Prison," said Holmes. "I saw you there, inside the prison, early on a December morning in 1884. You were being led by one of the surlier day wardens. He took you to the women's wing, probably conjecturing that it might seem less oppressive to a renowned author's sensibilities. But the warden with a small lamp was so far ahead of you that you seemed alone, squeezing up the metal stairs from cell ward to cell ward with your shoulders brushing cold stone."
"Yes," cried James, amazed. "But I saw no other gentleman during my visit, not even Millbank's warden, with whom I had corresponded through the kind offices of a friend in Whitehall to receive permission for the visit. There was only that surly, as you say, and infinitely uncommunicative guard."
"Where were you, sir?
In the process, perhaps, of delivering some fiend you and Dr. Watson had just caught?"
"I was a prisoner," said Holmes. "I saw you through the tiny Judas hole in my cell's door. The guards were often too lazy to close it before you climbed the steps to the women's ward."
"A prisoner?" gasped James.
He knew his features were aghast, reflecting the shock he felt.
"I was there for a little more than 2 months in disguise. If a prison uniform, welts from beatings, and severe malnutrition from the slop Millbank served out can be called a disguise. And my plan was to get close to another inmate whom I was sure was a killer of young women. But I admit, Mr. James, that it crossed my mind more than once that if something were to happen to both Inspector Lestrade and the warden, I might be in Millbank to this day."
Who was the killer?
Asked James in a soft voice. An Oxford-educated barrister named Montague Druitt, said Holmes, his eyes veiled as he seemed to be looking backward in time. Druitt was also a schoolmaster with a record of occasional insanities, and was found one Sunday outside the school where he taught. He was covered in blood. Inside the school was the dead and vivisected body of a certain Mary O'Brien, one of his students. Druitt was found guilty by a lower court, but was in Millbank Prison only a few more days than I was. He had friends in high places, especially among the Inns of Court, and a second trial declared him innocent. They accepted his explanation that he had dropped by the school on a Sunday to pick up his books so that he could prepare his Monday lessons, found Miss O'Brien dead there, and, in his distress, held her body in his arms, thus explaining the copious amounts of blood on him. No knife was found on Mr. Druitt's person or in the vicinity of the crime, so the courts let him go. He was a gentleman, you see, said Holmes, but I saw Miss O'Brien's body before it was moved. She had been dismembered, sir. Her body had been eviscerated and was in pieces, each piece slashed and stabbed until she was turned almost inside out. Even the most compassionate gentleman would not have cradled that dissectionist's work.
So, you think he was guilty? Asked James.
After he was released, I found the knife where he dropped it down a nearby sewer, said Holmes. It actually had his initials inscribed on it. And I was in the same terrible cell with him for 7 weeks. He never fully confessed to the crime, Watson. I'm terribly sorry, Mr. James. But in the privacy of that dark, dank cell along the Thames, Druitt smirked enough to me about no one ever solving the crime that, in my professional opinion, he all but bragged of committing it.
Surely Scotland Yard must have arrested him again after you showed them the knife and told them of his demeanor, said James.
Scotland Yard misses much, Mr. James, including this knife in their searches just after the crime, including the family history of Druitt's bouts of madness. But Scotland Yard does not want to advertise the things and criminals they miss.
That's terrible, said James, looking at Holmes in a new and strange light. What happened to Mr. Montague Druitt?
After his release from Millbank, he returned to an ever more successful career as a barrister, said Holmes. When the so-called Jack the Ripper murders in the East End captured the press's attention in 88, I joined Mr. Anderson of the CID in looking at many suspects. There were other murders of women through that period, but I was certain that the Ripper's victims were only five. The poor ladies Chapman, Stride, Nichols, Eddowes, and a certain Mary Kelly, who had known Miss O'Brien, who had been murdered in 1883. The man whom I became convinced was behind all the so-called Jack the Ripper murders was Mr. Montague Druitt.
But Jack the Ripper was never caught, said James.
No, but the body of Montague Druitt was fished out of the Thames on December 31st of 1888, said Holmes. The police ruled it a suicide.
Was it a suicide? Asked Henry James.
No, said Holmes.
His gray eyes now looked so cold to James that he would have described them as inhuman, reptilian, but a reptile that was both satisfied and deeply sad. Suddenly, Henry James felt his body grow cold, and a strange and unpleasant prickling flowed down his arms, the back of his neck, and along his spine. Eventually, James said, I thank you again for your comments about my Princess Casamassima. It pleases me that someone as thorough with detail as yourself approves of its research. Holmes smiled.
You remember the location of the Hotel Glenham
where we met Mr. Clemens last night for dinner?
Of course, said James. 995 Broadway.
Well, Mr. James, said Holmes, within 10 blocks of that hotel were more than 30 beer halls, union halls, lecture halls, and even churches where anarchists meet every week. For your American anarchists are primarily socialists, you see, and your American socialists are primarily German, moderately recent German immigrants, to be precise.
I would never have guessed that, sir, said Henry James. Of course, many of the workers in my Princess Casa Massima were German, but that was due to the prevailing feeling, the stereotype in England, as it were.
The German neighborhoods in the Lower East Side of New York are the nexus for 98% of anarchist sentiment and activity in America, continued Holmes, as if James had not even spoken. I found it located primarily in the 10th, 11th, and 17th wards. Germans refer to this part of New York as Klein Deutschland, Little Germany, as I am sure I don't have to translate for you. This area is bounded by 14th Street on the north, 3rd Avenue and the Bowery on the west, Division Street on the south, and the East River on the east. It has been Klein Deutschland since the Civil War.
Certainly, sir, protested James. You are not saying that all German immigrants in New York are anarchists.
Holmes was still smiling.
Of course not, he said softly. But I am saying that a surprisingly large number of your German immigrants have brought socialism with them from Europe.
And at the core of the most fanatical socialism lie the embers and sparks of today's anarchism and terror.
I find this hard to believe, said James.
Between 1861 and 1870, continued Holmes, some 0.3% of your immigrants were from Austria and Hungary, fewer than 8,000 people. Between 1881 and 1890, more than 6.7% of your immigrants are Germans or Austrians, almost 7% of your total. Some 82,000 people, most of whom chose to reside in the most crowded sections of New York or Brooklyn and not move west. And the ratio is rising dramatically. Demographers working in my brother Mycroft's department at Whitehall predict, rather confidently, I feel, that a full 16% of your immigrant population will be German by the year 1900. Almost 600,000 German men and women and children. And by 1910, lower-class Germans should be almost 25% of your total immigration, numbering more than 2 million.
But certainly there are German immigrants who are hard-working, God-fearing. I mean, you mention only a few German beer halls, stammered James.
There are more than 200 German beer halls associated with the anarchist movement in New York City right now. Just in 1893, said Holmes. Many of these are what they call Lokalfrage, secure places where they can speak freely or hold socialist meetings where they can openly discuss anarchist plans.
Holmes leaned forward, his weight on his walking stick.
And yes, your German immigrants are very hard-working, Mr. James. I can tell you that by working alongside them under the most inhuman of conditions in factories in New York. But the majority of them resist learning the English language, and the literate among them, and literacy is high in the German community, as you doubtlessly know, have read and absorbed their European communist anarchist philosophers such as Bakunin, and recently have moved on to the more violent communist anarchist leaders such as Peter Kropotkin, Errico Malatesta, and Elisée Reclus. Your German immigrants have brought with them not only their capacity for hard work 6 long days a week, but their hatred of the upper classes and their interest in anarchy, and for a minority, but still for too many of them, a willingness to turn to the bombings, uprisings, and the assassinations of all-out anarchy.
Holmes patted his cane absently, as if his own recitation upset him.
Socialists and anarchists also use these beer house Lokalfrage as clubhouses for trade union locals, singing societies, and German mutual aid organizations. But the anarchists, including the most virulent kind, Mr. James, also meet there, store weapons there, make their plans for assassinations there. And we could have walked to a dozen of these Lokalfrage from the Glenham Hotel last night.
James desperately needed to change the subject. Many of his characters in The Princess Casamassima had been German immigrant workers, but Henry James actually knew no such Germans, no industrial workers. The Germans he did know were teachers, professors, artists, and literary men in Germany itself. He said, "But the man you are seeking, this Lucan Adler, he is not German."
"No," said Holmes in a strange tone. "Lucan Adler is not German."
Knowing he should stay silent and let this disturbing conversation die, he still spoke.
"This search for the person behind Clover Adams's death, the search for Lucan Adler, Mr. Sebastian Moran's bastard son, is terribly personal to you. Is it not, Mr. Holmes?"
Holmes stared at him with those cold gray eyes and nodded ever so slightly.
"It must be because of the wounds," said James. "Those terrible gunshot wounds inflicted upon you by Lucan Adler."
Incredibly, inexplicably, Sherlock Holmes smiled. He flung his long black scarf around his neck in the flamboyant manner James had become accustomed to, while cocking his head back, chin jutting strongly beneath that odd, almost light-hearted smile.
"Not at all," said Holmes. "The wounds are a price of my profession. But it's true, I seek out Lucan Adler for a deeper reason than an attempt to save untold public figures from the world's most terrible anarchical assassin. You see, Mr. James, Sebastian Moran took the small child Lucan away from Irene Adler, claiming him and raising him as his bastard, even though he never gave the boy his last name. He trained Lucan in every dark art of murder that he knew, and young Lucan, no older than 21 years of age, learned even more on his own, surpassing Moran as both a marksman and an assassin."
Holmes looked directly into James's eyes, the detective's fathomless gaze meeting James's frightened but deeply curious and unblinking gray gaze in return.
"Trust me that I have more reasons for finding Lucan Adler than I can share at this time," said Holmes. "He needs to be put to death, but I hope to speak with him first."
Part 2. 1. The Damned Cross in the Stonework. Henry Adams awoke in his own bed in his Lafayette Square mansion, and for a moment he was disoriented. The air seemed too cool, the bed too familiar, the morning light too soft, and the floor was not moving. Adams had enjoyed his last 2 months of lounging in Havana with a friend, then spending a fortnight at Senator Don Cameron's place at Coffin Point on St. Helena Island. And, most of all, he'd enjoyed geologizing on the coral reefs with the zoologist Alexander Agassiz, son of the famous geologist Louis Agassiz, on Agassiz's comfortable yacht, Wild Duck. But now he was home, a place he'd mostly preferred not to be in the 7 years since his wife's suicide. And after his bath, he found his clothes laid out for him by his own valet rather than by one of Don Cameron's people. Having been so emotionally solitary in the past 7 years, Adams had expected to feel some sense of relief when his Shay, he'd been met at the station as requested only by his driver, had pulled up in front of his home on H Street, next to the Hayes similar mansion fronting on 16th Street. If for no other reason than his constant daily socializing, first with Phillips in Havana, then with the Camerons, then with Agassiz, and finally with the Camerons yet again, would be at an end. But instead, he'd felt a wall of depression wash over him as he approached the familiar arches of his front door. Clover hadn't died in this house, of course, or he'd never have returned to it. They'd been planning to move in on New Year's Day, 1886, after the 2 years of elaborate work inside and out was finished, but Clover had drunk her developing chemicals poison on December 6th. But the damn cross she'd insisted on, without his approval, was there above the elaborately scrolled stonework above the arches. He and Clover had been at Beverly Farms that July when the cross, the damned cross, had been added to the facade of the stonework. Henry had asked his friend from the State Department Library, Ted Dwight, to oversee that important bit of stonework and engraving, and he'd written to Dwight, "If you see workmen carving a Christian emblem, remonstrate with them like a father." The place between the windows above the main pillars needed something decorative, insisted their architect, H.H. Richardson. So Henry had suggested to Clover that a peacock be carved there, since, to his way of thinking, the entire new mansion, complete with its beautiful art, furniture, and contents, was a way of showing off for a Washington society he and Clover had snubbed at the best of times. Richardson had argued for a lion, roaring and rampant. Perhaps, Henry Adams thought, because the huge architect had been forced to put up with so many of Henry's roars and complaints over the course of building this impressive mausoleum for the living. But it turned out that, secretly, from Henry's point of view, Clover had ordered an elaborate stone cross to be carved into the brick space there between the windows. By the time Adams at Beverly Farms had heard the news of the cross, the stonework was a done deed. It had bothered him deeply. Neither he nor Clover were religious in any way. They'd often made light fun of their less-than-pious Washington acquaintances who'd managed to work Christian symbols into the stonework or interior carvings of their expensive new homes. When Ted Dwight had written to inform him that the cross had been added by artisans under Richardson's supervision at Mrs. Adams's insistence, Henry had written what he hoped had been a light-hearted-sounding letter in which he said, "Your account of the cross and the carving fills my heart with sadness and steeps my lips with cocaine." And he'd added, "Never fear, Ted. We shall plaster over it with cement soon enough." But of course, they never had. So he'd also written to Dwight, "It's a done thing, a fait accompli in stone, so I can neither revolt nor complain, though the whole thing seems to me bad art and bad taste. I have protested in vain and must henceforth hold my tongue." But he'd also asked Ted not to tell anyone else about the cross yet, since Washingtonians chatter so much that one is forced to deny them food for gossip. Goodness knows that Clover had provided them all with years of food for gossip within 6 months of that cross going up. She, a December suicide, lying dead on the carpet of their living room at the Little White House at 1607 H Street. The cross, rising between two arches, was a backdrop for a carved medallion showing off a slightly indefinable winged beast. Certainly not Pegasus, not quite a griffin nor a dragon, though Adams had wished it might have been. Whatever Clover had in mind when she ordered Richardson to add that design remained a mystery to this day. But even in the summer and autumn of that fateful 1885, Henry had written to friends that the damned cross and its winged creature was prophetic of the future, and that they filled him with terror. They still did. He had no idea, save for his peripatetic absence at the mansion being more common than his solitary presence in the past 7 years, why he hadn't gotten rid of the cross and winged monstrosity after Clover's death. To Adams, that entire horrible year had been filled with omens. That spring of 1885, when the minister was trying to impress upon Clover, with the utmost care, sympathy, and gentleness, that her father was indeed dying, Adams had heard her say, "No,
No, no, everything seems unreal. I hardly know what we are saying or why we are here. And if it seems so unreal, it must be. Or at least I must be.
And during that hot, miserable, endless, and pointless summer at Beverly Farms while Richardson was obeying Clover's secret orders to carve that abomination into the front of their staggeringly expensive new home, Adams had, upon more than one occasion, heard his wife cry out to her sister,
"Ellen, I am not real. Oh, make me real. For God's sake, make me real. You, all of you are real. Make me real as well."
As Adams breakfasted alone that morning, he had frequently breakfasted, had lunch, and dined alone for the past 7 years, as long as he was in this house and not traveling, he thought of the damned cross on the wall, and of that sick, hot summer at Beverly Farm, and of Clover's growing melancholia, and, yes, insanity. Then he put all of that firmly out of his mind, and went into his study to go over his pile of recent unforwarded and shamefully unanswered correspondence. It was late morning when his head butler knocked softly, entered, and said,
"Mr. Holmes is here to see you, sir."
"Holmes!" cried Adams. "Good heavens!"
He put down his pen, buttoned his jacket, and hurried out to the foyer where Holmes had just handed his hat and coat to the second butler.
"My dear Holmes," cried Adams, stepping forward to shake his friend's hand with the special holding the elbow with his left hand handshake that he reserved for old friends with whom he really wasn't that close.
"I had no idea you were in town," continued Adams. "Please come in. Can you stay for luncheon?"
"I can stay for only a minute," said Holmes. "I need to catch my train back to Boston in an hour. But I would happily sit in your study with you for a few moments, and would heartily welcome a cup of coffee."
Adams gave orders for the coffee to be brewed fresh, and led Holmes to his study. At 5'6", Henry Brooks Adams had never felt tall, even among the shorter Americans of the 19th century, but he always felt especially short next to Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. Holmes was still junior, even at age 52, because his famous father was still alive. He'd not yet struck off the mildly subordinating appellation as Henry James had a decade earlier upon the death of his father. But with Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr., even the junior seemed to add to his appropriate grandeur. Even while standing in the foyer with Holmes, Adams had realized that his old acquaintance was becoming more handsome in his 50s. Tall, erect, the high collar trying to hide his one flaw, a neck that some said was too long, with his perfectly curved mustache only beginning to go gray, and his perfectly parted hair contrasting boldly with Henry Adams's bald pate. And not only bald, Adams knew, but still peeling from the various sunburns he'd suffered on St. Helena and on Agassiz's yacht, despite constantly wearing yachting caps and straw hats. As the steaming coffee came, Adams realized that even though he was only 55, 3 years older than Holmes, it was his destiny to continue to grow balder and fatter and, yes, shorter, while Holmes would almost certainly keep his erect, tall, parade-ground, proud posture into his 90s and would probably reach the apogee of his male beauty in his 80s.
"What brings you to Washington, Wendell?" asked Adams. "Down to see Chief Justice Fuller, perhaps?"
"Yes, Justice Fuller and President Cleveland," said Holmes, carefully sipping his coffee.
He did not offer to explain why he would be seeing the president, and Adams pointedly did not ask. Holmes had been serving as an associate justice on the Massachusetts Supreme Court since 1883, and most astute observers, Adams knew, expected him to be chief justice of that state before long. Others would lay odds that before another decade was out, Holmes would be on the U.S. Supreme Court, although Adams had his private doubts about that.
"Well, how is Mrs. Holmes?" asked Adams. "Well, I hope."
"Fanny is quite well, thank you.
It had been John Hay who had once commented privately to Adams about the slightly dismissive tone that always was present when Wendell mentioned his wife. Hay and Adams were in silent agreement that if ever there were a purely companionate marriage, the Holmeses was such. Holmes set down his cup and saucer on a trivet the butler had placed on the top of a low bookcase next to his chair.
"I stopped by to ask you about these rumors," said Holmes in his old, somewhat abrupt manner.
"Rumors?"
Adams felt his heart race when he knew he shouldn't be alarmed. Lizzie Cameron would never reveal the contents of their personal letters, especially not Adams's last and most personal letter to her, from Scotland to Paris, just a couple of months earlier. Still, his pulse pounded with anxiety.
"About the Hayes visitors," said Holmes.
Adams let his eyebrows rise.
"I wasn't aware that John and Clara had any visitors of special note, but then I've been traveling a while now."
"So Hay told me when I stopped by next door a few minutes ago," said Holmes. "But your service staff must be buzzing about the visitors. Mine certainly are."
"Your servants in Boston are buzzing about the Hayes visitors?"
Adams cried with a smile.
"Of course not. But I've been here in Washington several days now, and I always bring my personal valet and cook along."
Adams folded his hands under his chin and smiled openly.
"I've not had time to hear my servants whispering. By all means, Holmes, tell me the gossip."
Holmes made a flicking motion with his hand, Adams noticing the long, tapering, perfectly manicured fingers, and said,
"It's certain that Henry James is back. He was staying with the Hayes for the past week or so. I just missed him, evidently. He's taken up lodgings nearby, at Mrs. Stevens's place, I believe."
"Clover arranged for Harry to stay there 10 years ago, the last time he was here," said Adams in a low voice.
Holmes nodded impatiently.
"I stopped by Mrs. Stevens's place before coming back here, but both James and his fellow lodger, the Hayes' other guest this past week and more, were out."
"I wonder what Harry came back for," mused Adams.
Just before Henry James had left America in 1883, after his parents' deaths and all the problems created by his father's will and properties in Albany, Adams had heard him swear that that would be his last visit to America. His home now was in England and Europe, their old friend had said.
"Whatever brought him back, he's trying to keep the visit confidential," said Holmes.
Adams steepled his fingers and tapped his bearded chain.
"Why would Harry want to do that? Unless... But William is in good health and away with his family to Italy or Switzerland or somewhere, the last I heard. And I believe there were no complications last year with Harry's sister Alice's will. Miss Loring brought the poor girl's ashes home last year to be interred in the family plot in Cambridge."
"Perhaps the confidentiality relates to James's companion, or rather companions, on this trip," Holmes said softly, leaning forward over the desk. "Two men, both rather strange from what I hear."
Adams allowed his steepled fingers to tap his lips. If Wendell's gossip was about some physical liaison that Harry finally allowed to occur with some other man, on his encounters with Harry in England and the continent, Adams had sensed the almost perfectly hidden infatuation that James felt toward some of his younger male artist friends. Adams most assuredly did not want to hear about it. He hoped that his expression and posture, while seemingly neutral, conveyed this message to the often too blunt and sometimes indiscreet Wendell.
"Who are these traveling companions?"
Adams asked with no great show of curiosity.
"Certainly they must be above reproach if Harry is introducing them to the Hayes."
Rumors of Oscar Wilde's private behavior crossed his mind, but he smiled away such an absurd thought about Henry James. Harry, while loving gossip as much as the rest of their male epistolary circle, was perhaps the most essentially private person Adams had ever known.
"Certainly, certainly," Holmes was muttering. "But one of the guests, Hay says that he left some days ago, was supposedly the Norwegian, or perhaps it was Swede, Jan Sigurdsson, you may have read about in the past year or two, an explorer of some sort." Adams dropped his small hands to his lap.
Sigerson. Sigerson, yes, I vaguely recall the name. Norwegian, I believe. He was in the news briefly a year or two ago for climbing some mountain or finding some pass in the Himalayas, wasn't it? Or spending some time in Tibet, perhaps. That is unusual.
Adams was speaking as a veteran world traveler. After Clover's death, he'd wandered around the South Seas for almost a year with the artist John Lafarge. It had been a telegram from Paris, from Lizzie Cameron, that had brought him rushing back around the planet like a fool. Adams set that out of his mind.
Yes, I remember something about a Jan Sigerson, he said again. So the explorer has come to America with Harry. Odd, but I fail to see any reason for Harry to keep his presence in America secret from old friends, unless Mr. Sigerson desperately wishes to avoid publicity, and Harry was waiting for him to depart before notifying the rest of us.
It's Hayes' second guest, also James's traveling companion, that has the servants buzzing, said Holmes,
who brought out his watch from where it was set in his vest pocket, next to his Phi Beta Kappa key, and checked the time. It was a short ride to the train station from Adams's home, and Henry had noticed that Holmes had his cab waiting.
Do you want me to guess the second gentleman's name?
Asked Adams with another friendly smile.
You wouldn't in 100 years, said Associate Justice Holmes with heavy, measured tones. It is Sherlock Holmes.
Adams laughed heartily, actually slapping his knees under the desk.
You laugh, observed Holmes.
Adams's old acquaintance, they had known each other for more than 30 years, had never been known for his sense of humor, certainly not in the way John Hay and Clarence King might have been. But since he had taken up his black robes of the Massachusetts court, he seemed especially humorless to Adams.
But isn't Sherlock Holmes a fictional character? Said Adams, not really making it a question. A creation of Arthur Conan Doyle? Did Harry bring Mr. Doyle on a visit to Washington?
No, he brought Sherlock Holmes, repeated Holmes. I almost got John Hay to admit it, although he seemed bound to confidence. Not only have his servants been whispering about the London detective being a guest in the house, but Clara Hay, after making her friends take an absolute oath of secrecy, has told about 100 of those friends of Sherlock Holmes's days in the house.
Perhaps an English relative of yours?
Asked Adams, his mischievous smile back.
Certainly not that I know of, said Holmes, who was looking at his watch again. I must go if I'm to get my luggage sorted out at the station before boarding.
But before he stood, Adams said,
Was this Sherlock Holmes, the second lodger at Mrs. Stevens's home, that you attempted to see along with Harry this morning?
Yes,
said Holmes, already moving with much longer strides with Henry toward the foyer, where the head butler, Addison, stood waiting with the justice's coat, hat, and cane.
What would you like me to do?
Adams said softly as the two men stood in the open doorway. The late March morning air was still chill.
Watch out my window and send you a report on whether this Sherlock Holmes looks fictional or not.
You still do not dine out all that much, do you, Henry?
Holmes asked bluntly.
Not really, said Adams.
In the 7 years since Clover's death, he'd come to be known as a recluse, and now the invitations, save from Clarence King when he was in town or John Hay next door, old members of the Five of Hearts, no longer came in.
You know how it is in this town, Adams heard himself saying. If you accept someone's dinner invitation, then the favor must be returned. I dine here now usually with the occasional fellow old widower or young bachelor.
Well, you'll be invited by Hay to dine Sunday evening with a young widower whom we both know well. And since this Mr. Sherlock Holmes is reputed to be one of the other guests, I had hoped you'd write me about that.
A young widower whom we both know well,
began Adams as he walked Holmes outside under the arches and that damned cross.
You don't mean...
I do mean,
said Holmes almost crossly to Adams's sensitive ear.
The boy.
The boy? Oh, dear me, was all that Adams could muster.
He waved to Holmes's carriage, knowing full well that Wendell never looked back until it disappeared around the corner.
The boy, muttered Adams,
feeling that he had made a great mistake in coming home several days sooner than he'd originally planned.
Oh, dear me.
2. 7 inches below floor level and sinking. Holmes much preferred their new living areas in Mrs. Stevens' home to being a guest at the home of John and Clara Hay. It was true that even here at this boarding house, Henry James was still residing in the same house as Holmes, but the door to James's bed-sitting room was down a long hallway, and they no longer had to see each other constantly or to share a meal. But first and foremost in importance was his freedom. The second story had its own outside door and wooden staircase, and each tenant received a key to that door. Holmes was free now to come and go whenever he pleased, and in whatever guise he chose, without scrutiny by Henry James or the Hayes servants. This morning, he was in no disguise. He wore his London-tailored suit, waistcoat, top hat and gloves, long black scarf, and was carrying his cane, sheathing a three-sided razor-sharp 30-inch sword. Across Lafayette Square, Holmes hailed a hansom cab and told the driver to take him to the Metropolitan Police Department headquarters at the corner of 5th and Louisiana. Once there, he had the driver park across the street from the old run-down precinct house. Holmes didn't have to wait more than 10 minutes before the major and superintendent of the Metropolitan Police, William C. Moore, came down the steps, glanced irritably at his watch, and hailed a cab. Holmes ordered his driver to follow that cab, even though he knew where it was headed. Holmes had never met Major and Superintendent Moore, but he'd studied photographs of him, and there was no mistaking that white, General Robert E. Lee-type beard. And he knew that the irritability he'd glimpsed ran deep this morning, since the major and superintendent was not accustomed to being summoned anywhere by anyone, much less to the unimportant Maltby building, by order of someone in the mere State Department. Holmes's cab drew to the curb at the corner of New Jersey Street and Constitution Avenue, just as Moore had alighted, and almost bumped into the former major and superintendent of the Metropolitan Police, William G. Brock. Where Moore's beard looked full, white, and happily plumped, former Major and Superintendent Brock's beard was a straggly gray that matched his haggard appearance.
What are you doing here? Began Moore.
I might ask the same of you, sir, snapped Brock.
The two men disliked one another intensely. More to the point, Holmes did know former Major and Superintendent Brock by sight, and vice versa. Brock had reason, or thought he did, to hate Holmes even more than he detested the current major and superintendent of police. Holmes waited until the two men, still grumbling and demanding answers from one another, went into the building before he stepped out of his cab and paid the driver. Holmes had asked John Hay about the Maltby building the previous week, mentioning only that he'd passed by the odd-looking building, and Hay had laughed and explained that the lift inside was treacherous because the Maltby building, a 5-story apartment building purchased 20 years earlier to provide overflow space for Senate offices, had been built on the site of an old stable by its New York developer. Essentially, as is true of so many things in Washington, Hay had said, the building had been built on sand. The massive elevator had begun sinking into the sand, dragging the entire building down with it. And now to enter the lift, one had to step up or down some 7 inches.
What's more, added Hay with an additional laugh, those offices still remaining in the Maltby building are freezing in the winter, literally intolerable in the summer, and cramped at all times.
Perfect, Holmes had thought, and had cabled his brother Mycroft to have Whitehall summon Major and Superintendents Moore and Brock and the others to the Office of Steamboat Inspection on the 4th floor of that building. The supervising Inspector General of Steamboat Inspection was a certain James A. Dismont, who had been warned by the State Department of this morning's invasion,
but had not been told the reason for the gathering. Now, when Dismont's flustered clerk, a certain Andrew McWilliams, according to the sign on his desk, led Holmes into the Inspector General's crowded office, it was also entry into a din of outraged voices, led by William C. Moores. Holmes rapped his cane soundly on the wooden floor 4 times, and all heads turned in his direction.
"Gentlemen," said Holmes, using his most commanding tone, "I am Mr. Sherlock Holmes, and it is at my request, relayed through Whitehall, your president, and your State Department, that we are all gathered here this morning. Mr. Dismont?"
Holmes nodded at the confused Inspector General of Steamboat Inspection.
"We shall need the use of your office for only about 45 minutes, and we invite you and your clerk, Mr. McWilliams, to leave the building and enjoy the lovely spring day for the next hour."
Dismont puffed his cheeks as if ready to argue, but then looked at the faces of the important men in his office, nodded curtly, and left, closing the door softly behind him. Holmes made sure that the Inspector General and his secretary were gone from the outer office, and then turned back to those same apoplectic faces, ready to explode at him. He held up one gloved finger.
"Stop," he said. "Before any remonstrations or demands are made, please understand that this meeting was approved by Her Majesty Queen Victoria and President Cleveland, and arranged by our Whitehall and your State Department, precisely for reasons of privacy."
"My office at police headquarters would have been perfectly private,"
thundered Major and Superintendent of Police Moore through his white whiskers.
"No, Major and Superintendent Moore, it would not have been," Holmes answered softly.
"For not only is the entrance to your police headquarters at Fifth and Louisiana being observed by scouts, touts you might call them, on the payroll of this city's criminal gangs, but there are members of your staff and police department also on that payroll."
"That is outrageous," roared Moore.
"As outrageous as the charges by Mr. Holmes more than 10 years ago that my detectives were corrupt,"
rasped former Major and Superintendent Brock.
"I lost my position in 1883 due to such rumor-mongering."
Holmes nodded.
"That was unfortunate," he said softly. "I was invited to America to look into the assassination of your President Garfield. More specifically, to see if the assassin Charles Guiteau was connected to the anarchist conspiracy that had later attempted to murder Queen Victoria. My investigations showed that Charles Guiteau acted alone and out of motives concocted only in his insane mind. But those same investigations showed the active corruption of many members of your detective bureau, including taking money from known anarchist conspirators."
Brock turned his back on Holmes and went to the window to look out. Before Moore could roar again, Holmes said,
"Let me introduce the 3 other gentlemen whom President Cleveland wanted to be here today."
Holmes nodded toward a short, handsome man standing near Brock and the window. The gentleman's mustache was waxed and curved in the French fashion. His dark hair was slicked close to his skull, but any sense of dandyism was immediately dismissed by his square jaw, firm mouth, and powerful gaze.
"Mr. William Rockhill, if I'm not mistaken," said Holmes. "Executive Secretary to the 3rd Assistant Secretary of State and our liaison with the State Department and various European governments, should the need arise to communicate with these governments."
Rockhill bowed toward Sherlock Holmes.
"Un plaisir de vous rencontrer, Monsieur Holmes."
He bowed to the other men.
"Mr. Vice President, gentlemen."
Holmes gestured toward a tall, silent man with his white hair parted in the middle, the only man in the room other than Holmes who was clean-shaven.
"You are Mr. Drummond, I presume?"
The tall man bowed slightly.
"Andrew L. Drummond, at your service. Mr. Drummond is currently chief of the Secret Service Division of the Department of the Treasury," said Holmes.
Drummond nodded his head again. His bright blue eyes seemed to show some slight amusement.
"What in blazes do the State Department or Treasury Department have to do with anything?"
roared Major and Superintendent Moore.
"And for that matter, sir,
The major and superintendent raised his cane in Holmes's direction.
Who the blazes are you? And by what authority do you summon the chief of the Metropolitan Police Department?
Before Holmes could answer, the sixth and final man in the room, the only one not yet introduced, a quiet, balding, mustached man in his early 60s, standing in the shadows of a corner, said softly,
I will answer that, Major and Superintendent Moore. I am Vice President Adlai E. Stevenson. Mr. Sherlock Holmes, England's most renowned and respected consulting detective, was asked to call today's meeting on the authority of President Cleveland, who has asked that everyone here might give their full cooperation on an issue of the gravest national importance.
Mr. Vice President,
stammered Major and Superintendent Moore, and fell silent. Holmes knew from Hay and others that Vice President Adlai Stevenson, elevated from assistant postmaster to vice president by a whim of Cleveland's party at the 1892 Democratic Convention, could walk into almost any party or assembly in Washington and not be recognized. Nor will Holmes be surprised 4 years hence, late in 1897, when he will read a small item in the Times of London. When asked whether President Cleveland had ever asked his opinion on any matter, Vice President Adlai E. Stevenson responded,
Not yet, but there are still several weeks remaining.